Today's episode is brought to you by our company, Sales Schema. Sales Schema helps agencies and B2B service companies build a reliable business development system through tasteful and targeted outreach. To learn more about us and check out our latest video training, go to salesschema.com/takecharge. Thanks for tuning in. As a quick intro, I'm giving away the audio version of my book, Relationship Sales at Scale, dripped out in several different parts. If you missed parts 1 through 4, please click below to backtrack so that you can get context on the whole methodology. And today I'm very excited to read you the 5th and final chapter of the book titled The Perfect Day Sales Process. To give a little background on this chapter, I'm going to turn to one of my favorite quotes, which is actually the name of the chapter of another book I love, The Road Less Stupid by Keith Cunningham. And that's that ordinary things done well create extraordinary results, or something to that effect. I might have slightly butchered it, but that's the idea. And this really matters because while the top of the funnel has changed a lot based on all the skepticism and noise that we're all facing, and that's what parts 1 through 4 were essentially about, is how to break through and build trust and de-risk conversations. In our experience, the bottom of the funnel hasn't changed a whole lot, because that's once you have somebody that's a fit, and once they are interested in what you're up to, at least on some level, you are dealing with the same foundational human wiring, which only changes very gradually over the course of thousands of years, perhaps. So while there is a market incentive to create all sorts of new takes on sales processes and so on, you can turn back to books from the 1900s, and the lessons and the best practices are very similar. From what we've seen with ourselves and with working with over 100 agencies and B2B service companies over the years, success at middle to bottom of the funnel, let's say, really comes from consistent practice and optimization with a few digital age upgrades, which I talk about in this section. Also, as a side note, this section is a lot more fun. There's a lot more stories and anecdotes and that kind of thing, and I think you're going to get a whole lot out of it. So without further ado, I'm going to get into reading part 5 of Relationship Sales at Scale. This is the 5th and final chapter. This and the previous chapters are going to be up and available for free for just a few more days. Or if you'd like to get the book in its entirety right now in whichever format you prefer, you can do that by scrolling to the bottom and clicking through to Amazon. Welcome to the Digital Agency Growth Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Englander. Part 5, The Perfect Day Sales Process. I'm in an outdoor beer garden in Austin, Texas on a warm summer night. My friend Joe, an accomplished enterprise sales leader for a large financial compliance company, is reminiscing about his first sales gig. In college and working in Tampa, Florida, he was a door-to-door salesman for a household security company, and the work was grueling. His colleagues included ex-cons, meth heads, and a guy who literally overdosed on energy drinks, was hospitalized, and went on to close 2 deals the same day. Each salesman, they were all men, worked late afternoons into the night, knocking on doors, building rapport, and pitching wildly after gaining access through the threshold of the front door, as if they were roaming capitalist vampires. The invite inside was the equivalent of getting agreement to an appointment in Joe's present-day role. And once inside, he grilled the homeowner to uncover pain points and security worries, and then launched into one of several versions of the security company's presentational scripts. And this entire carnival act somehow worked. Countless homeowners committed to long-term contracts, and salesmen regularly cleared 6 figures over the course of a summer alone. Through an unrelenting focus on process and training, the security company became the leader in the space despite having a crap product. Joe applies many of the lessons learned to his current role selling a 6-figure enterprise-focused compliance product. At this point, you're probably sighing, "This obnoxious boiler room crap won't work for me." You're mostly right, but Joe's story teaches at least a couple of important lessons. The first is that sales training, practice, and a finely tuned process can create an edge and be your biggest differentiator, even if your product or service is nothing special. There are countless similar stories of differentiation through process alone. I know salespeople who describe similar experiences working in credit card processing, precious metals, and payroll services, for example. While the tactics for selling consumer security systems will differ from selling enterprise IT consulting, let's say, in the same way that McDonald's marketing might differ from Le Bernardin's, this lesson is powerful. As Joe describes, building sales chops by hawking a commodity product is kind of like training for a marathon by running with weights strapped around your ankles. Just imagine how fast you will go once you remove the weights and sell a product that's actually special. The second lesson, sales is a transference of emotion, not information, and this requires that you spend a lot of time with your prospect. Joe's sales-driven company found a way to make this mutual time investment happen in one fell swoop over the course of an afternoon or evening. Be it a business or consumer product, the one-call close is rarely successful for complex services that demand a significant percentage of the prospect's net worth. This all maps to our client's experience and is echoed by Daniel Priestley, entrepreneur and author of Oversubscribed, who observed that big purchasing decisions will take about 7 hours or roughly one business day. The naive empiricists lose the plot and fixate on touch points, failing to appreciate the trust that must be built from mutual time investment. And arbitrary metrics are over-optimized at the expense of just about everything else. How many times have you heard this? It takes 10 touch points or whatever to break through to a prospect. But how much are these arbitrary touch points simply annoying people and hurting your brand? Negative brand effects are subjective and are very hard to measure, so they don't fit neatly into white papers, CRMs, and P&Ls, but they are very real. The good news is that nowadays, the perfect day does not have to happen entirely belly to belly, nor does it have to happen 100% digitally through impersonal blog posts or ads. It's choose your own adventure, and it can be a hybrid. When you measure your sales cycle, which might be weeks or months, it's essentially the perfect day playing out in bits and pieces across multiple prospects. The perfect day concept is intuitive, but most businesses either fail to start the process entirely, or they waste too much time and energy forcing prospects into an impersonal funnel across touch points, measuring things that don't matter. Instead of waiting around for prospects to find you or else playing roulette by pitching them on specific offerings they don't yet care about, the first part of this book hopefully gave you a framework for jumpstarting the perfect day by de-risking a meeting. Now, what do you do during that first real meeting, be it remote or in person? The rest of this section will help you answer that question and is grounded in free-floating lessons learned by myself and from others, including thought leaders who came before us. With that in mind, I'm going to let you in on a secret. The sales trainer has no clothes. Almost every sales trainer rebrands and regurgitates the same material, which changed very little over the last century. And I don't blame them. This chapter is going to be 80% regurgitation and 20% reframing. And I'm going to credit the giants on whose shoulders we are all standing. Sales training changed very little over a century because human psychology shifts very gradually, if at all. This dynamic is observed when you observe how salespeople can bounce between industries relatively easily in the same way that a Honda mechanic can work on a Toyota after several months of training. The nature of one-to-one human interaction and the wiring of the human brain are the same regardless of what you sell. Marketers, operations people, and HR professionals, on the other hand, have a lot more trouble bouncing around. Sales training has more in common with classic trades like apprenticing for a blacksmith or a lawyer than it does ramping up modern marketers. Yet every sales trainer is incentivized to package newfangled silver bullet formulas when the useful stuff is timeless. All that said, in the same way that door-to-door salespeople change their interactions with the telephone, you have to do the same for the shift to digital. As covered earlier, de-risking a conversation is very much about leaning into the same old-school tribal commonalities that have connected humans for millennia, be they personal or business. The game board changed when the internet introduced scale, information symmetry, and competition for attention and market share. These dynamics are changing the way prospects make decisions about when, where, why, and how they will invest their time and attention. But once that time and attention are invested, more of the age-old best practices apply, perhaps with a few minor tweaks. Think 30-degree turns, not 180s. To sum it up, the internet changed the top of the funnel a lot, but less so the middle to bottom of the funnel. Go from jazz to science. Alex Honnold is an American rock climber best known for his free solo ascents of big walls, in particular, his free soloing of El Capitan in Yosemite National Park in 2017. Alex's free solos are unprecedented feats, and when I watch videos of him climbing and leaping untethered thousands of feet in the air, my stomach turns. In interviews, journalists often assume that Alex, like so many extreme athletes, must be an adrenaline junkie, getting high on the thrill and nail-biting improvisation of free climbing. Alex's response to this common assumption is counterintuitive. He makes the point that when free soloing feels exciting and adrenaline fueled, something is very wrong. In reality, Alex's survival hinges on thousands of hours of guess and check experiments combined with meticulous journaling and analytical thinking. It's this process that inspires Honnold, not split-second decision-making or adrenaline highs. From the outside looking in, his climbing feats might look like death-defying free jazz, but his process is grounded in the unsexy scientific method. Be like Alex. For most complex service businesses, the sales process is jazz when it should be science. Due to lack of pipeline and training, as well as laziness, many salespeople wrongly think it's okay if their process is a free-flowing escapade. They dismiss plans and scripts, saying, "I don't want to sound like a robot," and they fly by the seats of their pants. Yet, many think they have it all figured out. One of the most common mantras we hear is, "Get us in the room and we'll close them." Then, when we ask the salesperson to take us through his process, a flock of ums and ahs flies out. This hubris happens when a firm only talks to late-stage referred prospects. And as you know by now, over-reliance on this group is unsustainable. Sales is a domain of continuous learning and small improvements over time, and overconfidence kills that progress. Keep in mind that low single-digit close rate improvements can mean millions in revenue. You will know your sales process is working when it feels sort of rote and scientific. Sure, the names, faces, and objections might vary, but the song stays mostly the same. You might, for example, introduce an experiment like a price test or a new presentation slide, but you're not reinventing the wheel. Once your process is grounded in science, you can slot someone else into it and move on to bigger and better things much more easily. In-person versus video calls. You might be wondering, how do I adjust between in-person and remote? Don't worry, the process we will cover applies to both, and adjusting for either situation will not mean rewriting your approach. That said, most of the upcoming section was honed in a distributed sales environment, and if you're not building your video chops, then you probably should be. First, let's admit it. Meeting belly to belly has its perks. You get more attention from your prospect and you can build a warmer connection. And if you stumble, it's easier to brush yourself off with charm and poise. Speaking on a video call, you'll have to work harder to keep your prospect's attention as strangers can become distant and drift to their phones and competing browser tabs. And you have to roll with the technical punches like glitches and slow internet. That said, the opportunity cost of not building a remote-ready process far outweighs the upside of only doing business with those you can meet in person. If you own a local restaurant, that's one thing. But if you're a digital service business and you can't persuade prospects unless you can be in the same room, then you're passing on the biggest opportunity offered by the internet and your competitors will scoop it up. As Warren Buffett famously said, only when the tide goes out do you discover who's been swimming naked. And for many, that's what it's like to jump into the cold water of remote sales when you're used to in person. The new medium will reveal the holes in your game, but you will come out stronger when you plug them. It's not that you will have to completely overhaul your process for video calls, but you'll have to tighten it up and streamline things. And the good news is that you will be able to test new elements much easier than if you had to jump in a car or a plane every time. Moving your process forward. As we covered, you now have a division of duties in your sales process and your outreach squad is helping you tee up meetings. If you're solo or small, then make sure you're dividing up blocks of undistracted time between each role. Once you land a meeting with a senior enough person in a pre-identified account, now you're in the realm of the closer. Most of the closer's time should be spent on mid to bottom of funnel activities like building relationships, presenting, and persuading. So what do you do on the first call and beyond? The traditional sales process for a complex product or service involves an exhaustive interview where the salesperson learned dozens of minute details and presented hyper-custom proposals. This process is a vestige of a bygone era when buyers had a lot less information than sellers. Things have changed, and even when a prospect is not an expert, she understands the problem you solve and how you generally solve it before she logs on to Zoom. Remember earlier when I talked about that 30-degree turn in response to digital? Here is where it goes down, and one of the strongest reframes is offered by the Challenger Sale by Matthew Dixon and Brent Adamson, which is grounded in extensive research. While Gene Schwartz's Breakthrough Advertising described why complex service prospects are skeptical now, the Challenger Sale covers how you can best communicate with them. The book covers a lot of ground, but one of the most important lessons is its instruction to salespeople to, number one, teach, number two, tailor, number three, take control. All the effective sales processes we've observed over the years at Sales Schema, including our own,
follow this course. Regardless of your offering, if all of your actions flow from these three overarching steps and you spend a perfect day with your prospect, you have a reliable process for predictable growth. A battle-tested sales process for complex services. On the Digital Agency Growth Podcast that I host every week, we interview John Sourakis, President and CRO of Oyova, a 25-person Inc. 5000 marketing agency focused on web and application development. You can find the full video interview in the resources section by going to salesschema.com/audible. While John's core service might live in the middle of the smile graph as seen in part one, his sales process positions his agency firmly in the strategy section from the get-go. John's process takes place across 3 to 4 video calls. Step one, qualification. Step two, team discovery. Assign relevant teams /decision makers. If budget, skip to step four. If no budget, sell paid strategy /step 3. Step three is a paid strategy /discovery session, learn and build outline. Step four, present outline. John might ask, how does that land with you? If ready, send proposal for immediate signature. If not ready, skip to step five. Step five, feedback call. Answer questions, get verbal agreement or no. Step six, proposal for sign off. A formality. As John jokes, it could be written on a napkin. Between each stage of the process, John and his team always lock down the next step, saying, to keep momentum and not get lost, I would like to set up the next call. How does Tuesday at 2 p.m. work for you? As John points out, this perfect day process is time-consuming and expensive, but it's effective and highly profitable. During John's qualification and discovery sessions, he learns about deep business problems and outlines ideas and models for solving them. The how, design and development, is window dressing. With the smile graph and the importance of teaching in mind, John's sales process positions his team as a group of highly paid strategists from the get-go, instilling the point that they will influence big, costly decisions. On the other hand, most of John's competitors get themselves stuck in the dead zone by focusing on the how instead of the why. Can we build you a website? The exact stages in your process will depend on your offering, and if you've never mapped out a process like this, start simple and add steps as needed. While it's unlikely that your prospect will agree to invest $50,000 or more, let's say, on a one-call close, you may or may not need 5 meetings. The rest of the section will focus on the most important starting stage, your initial qualification call. Yes, you need a script. You might cringe at the word script, but keep an open mind. Words are powerful and a script doesn't make you a robot. Every effective sales process for simple and complex services alike relies on some level of scripting. Sales, in its most boiled down form, is simply the right words spoken to the right people. So doesn't it make sense to think about those words and how you say them? Remember the science instead of jazz philosophy? Your script is where the science plays out, even if you have to make changes based on anecdotal evidence. More on that later. To tie this section together, the following script is a composite of 5 to 10 effective processes we've observed for qualifying and advancing new prospects. Chances are the script won't match your situation perfectly, but it'll help you draw inspiration. From there, the rest of this section will dig into context behind key elements so you can tailor the script to your situation.
As a quick break, I wanted to let you know about our newest video training, How to Take Charge of Your Agency's Future Revenue. By the end of this training, you're going to learn how we get 2 to 5 qualified appointments every week using tasteful and highly targeted email outreach. That might not sound like a lot, but once you understand the outreach napkin math, you're going to learn how this can lead to massive scale for your agency or B2B service company. In addition to that, you're going to learn the 6 steps for successful outreach campaigns based on everything that we've learned from working with more than 100 agencies since 2014. You're going to get the complete agency outreach tech stack so you understand the right tools for getting the right results. And you're going to see agency to brand email examples and get inspiration from high converting campaigns. So to get this 30-minute training, all you need to do is go to salesschema.com/take charge. Again, that's salesschema.com/take charge.
BANT. You might be familiar with the BANT framework. It's a system originally developed by IBM that stands for budget. Can they afford you? Authority. Are you talking to the right decision makers? Need. Do they have enough pain to commit to your solution? Time frame. Are there deadlines to decide and move forward? The BANT framework still holds strong, and it's a great way to decide which pitches to swing at so you can protect your time and resources accordingly. That said, simply going down the line and checking the boxes is not enough. BANT is a process, and some of the check marks will be there when you meet your prospect, while others will have to be uncovered and molded. For example, per John's process, maybe your prospect does not initially check the need box, but through a paid strategy, they realize how much a subpar website is costing them. Going further, BANT falls a bit short when it comes to understanding the who, what, when, where, and how of the decision-making process. If you have experience in complex sales situations, you probably know that one of the most challenging aspects of the job is wrangling decision makers and getting everyone in one room. Don't worry, the rest of the section will help with that effort. Give them the roadmap. One definition for a talented salesperson is that they are an effective manager of tension. Too much tension and prospects get cagey, skeptical, and resistant. Not enough, and you're probably avoiding the hard questions that will move your process forward. While you don't want to spill the beans about the inner workings of your service all at once, there is no reason to keep your sales process a secret. To build a foundation of comfort from the get-go, give your prospects the roadmap and let them know what to expect. For example, at Sales Schema, we ask a lot of questions and our prospects leave with more questions than answers. So we tell them explicitly that that will happen. It's not any given request by itself that tanks a deal, but it's the request without proper expectation setting and context. Here's how we open qualification calls at Sales Schema. Nice to connect. By the way, how did you find us? What, if anything, have you seen about what we're up to? On this call, no decision has to be made. We just need to figure out whether or not it makes sense to schedule a follow-up. And I'll ask some questions and go over what we're doing from a high level. On the next call, if that makes sense, we would get into a custom forecast and outline and a specific investment for you. From there, if this is something we should take further, we have a strategy call with our team and yours, including all decision makers, to determine how we would implement this. So on this call, you might leave with more questions than answers. Is it okay if I ask you some questions about your company? Beware of rose-colored listening. A while back, I was on a sales call with the owner of a mid-sized agency who was interested in our new business strategy and prospecting services. All the BANT boxes were checked, and we conducted a promising demo call followed by a strategy huddle with our mutual teams. The energy was great. There were smiles, nods of agreement, and it seemed like nothing could derail the momentum. On the final Q&A/decision call, the CEO deferred the decision for up to a year, saying that he and the team would be too busy with an upcoming acquisition. I remember that he mentioned the acquisition on our first call, but since there was so much positivity, I fell for rose-colored listening and ignored the trap door. From the get-go, I should have interrogated his plans and made him sell me on his team's commitment to executing a solution like ours in the face of competing priorities. Instead, we wasted a combined 10 hours on proposals and calls. We all get excited in the face of a big potential deal or promising partnership. And this is where it's important to keep your emotions in check and look for trap doors that could blow up your deal at the 11th hour. Sales leader and influencer Temple Naylor refers to this dynamic as happy years, and its influence is strong. He compares an effective sales process to the Scooby-Doo gang stalking through a spooky mansion hallway and routing out ghouls behind each door. While you don't have to be a sad sack pessimist worrying that every prospect will be a horrible fit, when you hear something that might be a red flag, poke at it. Some of the best salespeople we know state their reservations early and often. Here are a few questions I might have asked and said on the first call in response to the red flag. It sounds like you and your team will be busy with this acquisition. How much time each week do you think it will demand from your team? How important is it to keep up new business activity during this period? What happens if you halt your new business activity over the next 3 months? If we could take a lot of the prospecting work off of your plate and get super targeted with our outreach so you're talking to the right people, would that solve the problem? Are they feeling the burn? Rose-colored listening can play out in different ways, but one of the most common manifestations is when salespeople gloss over a prospect's previous experience with a competing or similar solution to yours. When a prospect has undergone a solution like yours, that experience, be it positive or negative, is the backdrop behind everything. So it's important to understand their relationship with the previous experience. More importantly, learning about the experience will tell you if you have a sophisticated or a less sophisticated buyer, which will guide the rest of your sales process. To understand the situation better, you might ask, have you ever hired an outside company to do what we do? If yes, find out if there is a wound, and if so, how fresh and painful it is. More on that below. If your prospect does have experience with a competing solution, here are a few follow-up questions you might ask. Have you ever hired an outside company to do what we do? Yes. When? How would you describe the experience? What were you expecting? How did it pan out? How do you think your results or experience compares to that of the previous provider's clients? Why do you think you got those particular results / had that experience? If it's a negative experience. So it sounds like you've hired a company like ours recently and it didn't pan out well for you. If you don't mind me asking, what would you be hoping to get from an engagement with a new partner? Get as tangible and as specific as possible. To make sure I understand, if we were able to build you a website interface designed to convert luxury e-commerce consumers in less than 6 months, would that be a win? On the other hand, if it's a positive experience, then you sell against yourself and go for a no. You might say, it sounds like you had a great experience with a solution kind of like ours. Why not just invest in that again? Experienced prospects are great for a couple of reasons. Number one, sales cycles are shorter. Number two, if you ask good questions, prospects will tell you exactly what and how to sell them. For example, prospect. We worked with a company at the beginning of the year and we got the feeling that they were really overstretched. Salesperson, interesting. Why did you get that feeling and how did it play out? Prospect, well, they assigned us to a junior and inexperienced account manager who constantly dropped the ball. Salesperson, got it. So if you're assigned to an experienced account manager with no more than 3 clients, would that be a win? Prospect, yes, that would be ideal. Later, you might offer to bring your account manager on a follow-up call for a meet and greet. Just remember that you are dealing with a sophisticated buyer, and this should impact the rest of your process. For example, you might cut to the chase a bit faster and drill down to the few tangible differentiators that will heal the specific pain your prospect experienced with the competing solution. Like John's process from earlier, you might skip the lengthy paid discovery, for example, and jump ahead to an outline. On the other hand, if your prospect never invested in a solution like yours, be it in-house or out-of-house, then you will need to go through a lengthier discovery and teaching process like John's. You might have to educate and give more of a 50,000-foot view on how your solution slots into place alongside competing options. For example, if you do content marketing and your prospect is comparing you against investing in trade shows, you might need to help them understand how content can be used to nurture leads acquired at events. Basically, you have to educate them so they don't compare apples to elephants. Doctor vibes. When you go for a checkup, does your doctor rant and rave about the perfect treatment right when you walk in the door? Not if she is competent. Instead, she soberly assesses your situation and offers a spirited treatment recommendation only when she is ready. While your service might not have life and death implications, your sales process is not worlds away. Yet too many salespeople get overexcited and become carnival barkers when they could double their close rate by behaving a little more medically. How to sell like a doctor. Number one, maintain a baseline level of enthusiasm. Keep your energy and poise at around 50%. This gives you room to go up when there is an important point you need to make. Number two, summarize. This instills the feeling of mutual understanding. You might say, it sounds like, just to make sure I understand, so you've done XYZ. Number three, listen to your prospect. This is cliched sales coaching advice, but it's true and it can't be overstated. Leave a 1 to 3 second beat after you ask a question, and depending on your experience and temperament, this may take some courage and practice. Money talk. One of the biggest areas of contention in blown-up deals happens with money talk or lack thereof. On one extreme, salespeople spill the beans right away and give specific prices before the prospect can understand or appreciate the context of the investment. These salespeople and their wares get put into a spreadsheet column somewhere, and the prospect, who is either unmoved or sticker shocked, drifts to the next shiny object. On the other extreme, many salespeople waste countless hours on prospects who can't afford them or who are otherwise emotionally unready for a given investment. The best salespeople price anchor prospects to a meaningful potential gain and or loss. From there, they discuss investment early and often, starting with a high ball rough range so they can qualify appropriately and set the right frame. They are the ones choosing the client, not the other way around. For most complex services, money talk happens on the first call. When a worthwhile person gets a high ball range, their first reaction is not, wow, that's expensive. Rather, it's, what don't I know? Examples, ROI-centric offers. What is your customer lifetime value? If you don't mind me asking, is there a revenue goal or other KPI you're looking to hit in the next 12 months? So it sounds like the goal, roughly speaking, would be to acquire X customers over the next 12 months. Do I have that right? Non-ROI-centric offers. We have different options, so I could figure out what might make sense. What was your rough investment in XYZ category in the last year? This investment would entail this particular range. How would you feel about that? Decision makers and timeframes. Remember the failed proposal pitch from part one? Here is a story that demonstrates how the same outcome can happen, but for completely different process-based reasons. I was on a check-in Zoom call with a client I'll call Raj, the head of new business for a New York creative agency. He was clearly irritated and dumbfounded as he took me through his two-month sales process with Terry, a marketing VP at a major consumer packaged goods company. We got Raj in touch with Terry through a mutual connection campaign like the one from earlier in this book. We identified a friend of a friend in one of the agency's targeted accounts and sent a tasteful message asking for an intro, which the connector happily obliged. After 2 months, Raj had gone through 5 to 6 calls with Terry, including qualification, in-depth discovery, outlines, proposals, follow-up calls, and countless email exchanges. Raj and Terry were peas in a pod, and as the agency's recommender, Raj assumed that Terry was selling him and the agency up the line and setting the stage for a fruitful partnership, kind of like a behind-the-scenes movie producer making big stuff happen. The deal was slated at $100,000, one of the biggest in the last 2 years. But after 2 months, Raj heard only crickets, and it was coming up on 4 weeks since he heard anything from Terry. Here's how my conversation with Raj played out that fine morning. Dan, did you qualify for Bantz? Raj, we did. Dan, did you present the proposal live, as you always should? Raj, yes, of course. Dan, at what point were you able to get all the decision makers in one room? Raj, silence. Dan, facepalm. Raj and his creative team went through their entire sales process and a lot more, which amounted to 20 hours of collective time or half of a working week. I wish I could say that this painful situation is rare or extreme, but it's not. Countless salespeople we've worked with torpedo their team's resources by failing to involve decision makers early. Yet, I get it. For many of us, it's hard to go outside of comfort zones and insist that the bosses get involved, especially when you have great rapport with the recommender. Raj worried that if he insisted that higher-ups get involved, that he might scuttle the deal. What if Raj's competitors gave Terry the information they wanted sooner or more conveniently? Wouldn't demanding the boss's involvement demean Terry, who was singing the agency's praises? If Raj held his ground, would it squash the potential for a future partnership? We all have these worries, and they are all usually overblown. When you draw a 10 and a face card in blackjack, you might still lose occasionally, but you are correct to hold your ground. Decision maker involvement is a must if you want to move deals forward while protecting your team's resources. You and you alone control your process. Sales coaches are full of finger waves about getting decision makers involved, but they are often short on tangible advice for how to actually do it. 99% of the time, ghosting happens because prospects are scared they will be forced into a decision. Here's the catch. If you don't explicitly say that they won't be forced into a decision, people assume they will. It's tempting to get mad at prospects for ghosting, but see the world in their eyes. Just like you, they have their team's time and resources as well as their credibility and reputation to protect. The simplest and most powerful change Raj can make next time is laying out the roadmap for his sales process from the beginning, whatever it may be for his unique offering. From there, after ensuring there's a general fit, Raj could ask the right questions to understand how decisions are made, and he should make better use of timeframes and deadlines. If there is urgency to solve a particular problem, then the sales process should be expedited and calls scheduled accordingly. If there is no urgency, then there is no use in mobilizing his team. He might ask, by when are you looking to decide on this and get the right help in place? So I can plan for our next conversation, how do you typically make decisions when it comes to marketing initiatives like this? As a friendly reminder, and as I mentioned on our first call, we need all decision makers on the strategy call so we can get back to you with the best possible proposal. Any issues with that? Great, let's find a time now, if you don't mind. How does Wednesday at 3 p.m. work? Remember, laying out your sales process firmly and clearly from the start will ensure compliance in most situations. And when you maintain the frame by talking about money early, decision-maker collaboration often happens organically. How to go Hollywood. Remember when we used to go to the movies? When the preview started rolling, what did the best coming attractions feature? Was it case studies and testimonials from fans of the upcoming movie, or was it real scenes from the movie itself? The answer is B, of course. Instead of a funhouse mirror representation of the product, the best marketing gives us a taste of the real thing, as if it were a single bite of a decadent chocolate cake. The power of sampling is obvious in consumer sales interactions. We taste appetizers at grocery stores, test drive cars, and take virtual tours of apartments. Yet in B2B sales interactions, most salespeople drop the ball on this opportunity. When it comes to selling complex services where the value is a little less tangible and takes longer to deliver, salespeople defer to dry case studies, testimonials, and awards, which are usually glossed over and ignored. Like business cards, case studies, portfolios, and decks have their place, but how can you do better? Instead of more collateral, here are a few ideas and real-life examples we've seen. A web design shop takes the webcam around the office and does a virtual meet and greet with their busy designers and developers who are cheekily annoyed, showing off intriguing and mysterious designs and works in progress. On a video call, a consultancy does a live tour of an actual strategy report for a recent client, including names and faces of real clients via LinkedIn. A performance marketing agency conducts a screen share showing real-time lead flow and dashboard updates for a few clients, including names and faces. A big part of achieving coming attraction level excitement is recency. New stuff is more powerful and it makes life with your offering feel like it's happening now instead of later. And the good news is that showing off real stuff requires the same or less work than building yet another detached case study. Instead of demoing everything at once, it's better to sprinkle your teasers throughout the whole process. At Sales Schema, for example, we show examples of email outreach copy and live campaigns for a few minutes on the first call, and then dig into curated examples later in the process. The goal is the kid on Christmas effect. Prospects should say, "I want that." The Ian Fleming rule. Remember the 80-20 rule of data from earlier? As you go deeper into the funnel and the prospects become fewer, the data goes from a babbling brook to a tiny trickle, and the 80-20 effect intensifies. Unless you have a gigantic boiler room sales team, the real data only comes after many months, and unfortunately, we can't always wait that long to make optimizations. You might know Ian Fleming as the author of the James Bond series, but he was also a prolific intelligence officer during World War II, and he was involved in planning numerous combat operations. In Fleming's Goldfinger, Auric Goldfinger, the novel's namesake villain, warned his nemesis. "Mr. Bond, they have a saying in Chicago. Once is happenstance, twice is coincidence. The third time, it's enemy action." This is a good rule for processing anecdotal evidence in your sales process and deciding where you should be proactive versus reactive. On one hand, dealing with every possible objection or issue proactively will break your process by sending it down rabbit holes. On the other, waiting for perfect statistical certainty means you're moving too slowly and losing deals. With that in mind, and assuming you're talking to the right prospects, if an objection or type of friction comes up 2 to 3 times over the course of a few months or less, it's probably worth addressing proactively. That said, if an issue is rare or one time, it's okay to handle it reactively. Most of the questions and objections that will ever arise surround one central question. Will this work for me? Before adding or subtracting elements from your sales process, consider how the given change will help answer that question. Don't be Enron. How to accurately forecast pipeline value. In 2001, the Enron scandal lost shareholders $74 billion, and it's known as one of the biggest frauds in history. While there were numerous bad actors and criminal activity, the company's accounting practices played a huge part. According to an article by the Corporate Finance Institute, the principal method that was employed by Enron to cook its books was an accounting method known as mark-to-market or MTM accounting. Under MTM accounting, assets can be recorded on a company's balance sheet at their fair market value as opposed to their book values. With MTM, companies can also list their profits as projections rather than actual numbers. MTM is kind of sort of like a vague pipeline forecast, and it enables employees, shareholders, business partners, and everyone else involved to join hands in a disastrous lie about the value of the company. Don't be Enron. Even though you're probably with a much smaller organization and hopefully you're a lot more ethical, we can all fool ourselves, either optimistically or pessimistically, about the value of our efforts. Let's say you're back to work after a long and relaxing weekend and you had a warm and promising conversation with the CEO of a big company the previous Friday. Your pipeline forecast might just spring up a bit. On the other hand, maybe you just endured the third no thanks call in a week followed by a fight with your spouse. Your forecast might tick down a bit. It's a given that you will find yourself in both of these boats at some point, and each will throw mud on the forecasting lens of your pipeline if you don't have the right framework in place. In our world, salespeople and managers fool themselves by using vague definitions for key stages of their process, and here are a few of the usual offenders. Qualified, shows intent, engaged, committed. If we talk to 10 salespeople in a week, we get 10 different definitions for qualified, for example. Instead, focus on simple and falsifiable actions. Simple equals a second grader would understand the info in your CRM. Falsifiable equals the status is answered by yes or no, but never maybe. Here is one example framework, and your steps will depend on your offering. As always, start with fewer and add stages as needed. Prospect stages. Number one, agreed to meet. Number two, qualification meeting on calendar. Number three, discovery on calendar. Number four, proposal meeting on calendar. Number five, verbal yes, proposal sent. Number six, proposal signed. Once you draft a few stages, let's look at how to determine likelihood to close. To help you out, you can find a pipeline template in the resources section at salesschema.com/audible, and your CRM is ultimately the best place to keep track of everything. In addition to avoiding the smoking of your own crack, tracking by simple stages will make it easier for future salespeople on your team to keep track of prospects. If you have this data already, great. But if your business historically comes from referrals and similar active need prospects, close rates will require some guesswork and approximation. Here's how to estimate close rate, even if your business comes from referrals. Number one, go through your CRM and or inbox and find a rough number for all the referral and active need prospects you received in the last 12 months. Number two, assuming you have at least 20 meetings or so, the more the better, identify how many closed. It's not uncommon to see close rates of 50% or higher for people in this situation. Number three, map this close rate to a later stage of your sales process. For example, you might plug this active need close rate into the proposal meeting on calendar stage. Predictable new business comes from building earlier stage relationships and not just talking to those with an active need. And this means that we have to figure out close rates for the earlier stages as well. There's no way to shortcut this, and you have to develop data over time. For clean data collection, as discussed, make sure to keep your stages simple and consistent. Otherwise, tracking and making sense of things becomes difficult. If you add a new stage, it's not very disruptive, but it's problematic if you remove a stage you have been using for a while. The invisible force. After more than a decade in sales and starting a company called Sales Schema, I feel like a hypocrite as my old sales coach tears my process a new one after observing a recorded proposal call. Admittedly, he is gracious and complimentary overall, but he gave a mic drop take on my process. Dan, you've always been very logical, but you forget about emotion when you're on these calls. He was right, of course, and I suspect I'm not alone. I've observed many busy salespeople and business owners in particular who fall into the same negative habit. When we are busy and pressured, it's easy to treat a sales interaction as something to be endured or defeated instead of a chance to understand and help. In most conversations, I went through the motions and checked off boxes. Are they qualified? Did I uncover broader financial goals? Did I make sure to lock down the next call? Are all decision makers on board? I lost the emotional anchor because I didn't care enough to ask the right questions in the right way. So my prospects became subtly detached and the void was filled for them by competing solutions or priorities. Usually in the face of useful feedback like this, I go full on logical, revamping my sales process or testing out a new offer, process, or turn of phrase. This time I kept everything the same, but shifted my mindset toward being magnanimous and helping my prospect on an individual level as much as possible. I know this advice might sound hackneyed and annoyingly lofty, but the emotional tie is the invisible force that weaves its way through each and every touch point, and a genuine focus on helping makes everything else fall into place. Here are a few things I experienced from this emotional shift. Became more observant, listened more, and slowed everything down. Asked better and more insightful questions. Understood the situation more completely from the first conversation. Disqualified much sooner, saving countless hours, and identified ideal long-term clients. Experienced much less stress. Instead of spinning plates and trying to defeat a video game boss, My only goal is helping out. Here are a few questions I found myself asking more often. How do you feel about that? If you don't mind me saying, it seems like you're worried about XYZ. What's on your shoulders personally when it comes to this? Parting words. As I type, I'm sitting in a coffee shop in the Upper West Side of Manhattan. And if I walk south down Amsterdam Avenue, a couple dozen blocks, and cut east across Central Park, I'll run into the Plaza District, where there are hundreds of towering office complexes housing ad agencies, consultancies, and law firms that scale to massive levels by, among other feats, building scalable new business systems, encompassing mini-trained professionals, and finely tuned processes. Those firms build effective new business systems, so why not you too, especially if it's at a smaller scale? While I want to challenge you, leaving out the caveats would be disingenuous, and the historian who lives in my brain is chirping at me. After all, those Plaza District service firms were fortunate enough to ride the big technological waves of their formative eras. The world was more consolidated than it is now. In the heyday of the Plaza District, the mediums of communication were narrowed to just a few channels of mass consumption, like television, radio, and mail. The 20th century ad agency, for one, afforded skyscrapers by acting as an aggregator, demanding better media rates from broadcast gatekeepers and gaining massive leverage at the negotiating table by bringing their clients to it in bulk. While we remember Don Draper's creative diatribes, it was the media salesman who cash flowed the whole operation. Similarly, the big consultancies once attracted the best and the brightest from the Ivy League institutions and demanded fortunes from publicly traded companies to provide them with raw information alone, regardless of its actual usability or predictive power. As a 20th century CEO, the consultant's pitch made sense. With fewer channels, companies, markets, and products, a small informational edge related to shelf space at a major department store or population growth in the Sun Belt might be powerful enough to pull ahead of the competition. In the 21st century, industrial mass production gave way to long-tail niches, and finite shelf space gave way to infinite shelf space, and the business strategies evolved for the former era don't work for our present and future. Right now, if I get up and take that schlep south to the Plaza District at the time of this writing, I will find more and more vacant and graffitied retail spaces. The best and the brightest are no longer flocking to the Plaza District. While some go to hotspots like Austin, San Francisco, or Silicon Valley, for all intents and purposes, we are location independent. In a decentralized world, the scarce and valuable commodity is no longer information, it's trust. The central question is, how do you build trust in a way that's scalable and reliable over a long period of time if you sell a complex and intangible service? The summarized answer to the trust question, like most things in life, is balance. Here are a few lessons I hope I imparted. Success comes from balancing timeless tribe-based trust with the scale offered by technology. Focus mostly on new business channels you can own and control. Hone in on the prospects who live within your circles of influence. If you wouldn't send it to someone you met in real life, don't send it to a stranger. Get leverage from division of duties, even if your team is small. Plan to spend a perfect day with your prospect. Sales, always and forever, is a transference of emotion, not information. We overestimate the amount we can accomplish in a short amount of time, but underestimate what we can accomplish over months and years. If you're ready to adapt to the new age and proactively build relationships with your future clients now instead of later, there's no reason you can't become a modern-day version of a Plaza District giant. Or maybe that's not you. Perhaps you want to one day get acquired and cash out big, or simply choose your clients instead of the other way around, do compelling work, and go home at a reasonable hour. All these outcomes are on the table for you and your business. After all, it's not just the multinationals that figure out how to build scalable new business systems. Many others crack the code, and we covered a number of them in this book. While you might not be able to ride the old waves that built the Plaza District, the good news is, there are many new and bigger swells, and the water is nice. Have a lovely swim. Dan Englander, New York, New York, November 30th, 2021.
Thanks so much for listening to all five parts of my book, Relationship Sales at Scale. If you want to get it all in one handy format for later review, you can do that by going to Amazon. Or if you would like to learn how we help agencies and B2B service companies implement this methodology, you can do that by going to salesschema.com. Thanks again, and hope to see you again before long. Thanks for listening to this episode. Again, today's episode is sponsored by our company, Sales Schema. Sales Schema helps agencies and B2B service companies build a reliable business development system through tasteful and targeted outreach. To learn more about us and check out our latest video training, again, you can go to salesschema.com/take charge. Again, that's salesschema.com/take charge.